Hi, Connor here. What you're about to hear is the test episode for the Watcher podcast. So, without further ado... So welcome to episode one of the Watcher podcast. This is where Richard and I get together. I, as an outsider who's interested, consult Richard, who is an insider to the country and is well informed, and I get him to explain stuff to me. Richard.
Hello. I've been thinking a lot, Connor, lately about, you know, I see a lot of people asking, like, how did we get here? You know, how come Trump happened? And I think that that's a question that doesn't have an easy answer unless you understand how the Republican Party got to a place where they were able to accept Trump. And I don't mean the establishment of the Republican Party, because that has pretty much been static since Nixon, I'd say, as far as like what the Republican establishment wants out of their political power.
Okay.
But the base has not been like the establishment very much. I would say during the Reagan years, maybe was the closest the base was to the establishment. But generally speaking, the establishment of the Republican Party has pretty much ignored their base until election time. And then they've just kind of scared them into voting for them. So what I wanted to do was just kind of start with Nixon and the Southern strategy. Does that feel like a place to go? I feel like that's maybe the place where things really started to shift for the Republican Party.
Okay.
Previously, the Republican Party was dotted all over the country, and there was such a thing as a Northern Republican in cities like New York City or Chicago. Well, maybe not Chicago. That's always been a Democratic bastion. But I would say there were Northern cities that had Republicans in them that you wouldn't think of as Republican now, like Minnesota, and maybe Syracuse or some of your upper East Coast cities. There were what you would call like an East Coast Republican. But that started to fade with the advent of the Civil Rights Act. There was a lot of friction. And it's very true within the Republican Party, I mean. And it started to break apart. Nixon put a lot to that with his environmental pushes and things. It wasn't really well received within the party itself, because at the time it was the nascent beginnings of the movement conservative, is what they call themselves. I have never really understood why movement, but I've read and they just started calling themselves that. I think maybe they were referring to movement within their own party.
Okay.
Well, Nixon saw that he couldn't win re-election. He knew he wasn't going to be able to win re-election. He was not very popular, and the only thing he could do was to grab like-minded people. And since Nixon was absolutely a racist, you know,
sure. Yeah.
he initiated what people refer to now as the Southern strategy. Interestingly, he went to a man by the name of Lee Atwater, who was close friends. Well, he's dead now, but at the time, Paul Manafort and Roger Stone were all close friends. There's some names that are infamous now. Like, why are those guys still in politics? I don't know, because Lee Atwater was the one who was the first Republican to really decide that to win elections, messaging was king. And he would say, he's got a quote along the lines of, you can't say N-word, 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 because people don't want to hear that. So you have to say busing and states' rights. Like, states' rights is really the only thing that has survived to today, although it really didn't get much past George W. Bush, I'd say, because nobody really uses that term anymore. But it was code for, we want to do whatever we want to do in our states, and if we're going to be racist about it, you can't say anything about it because we're in a republic. Yeah. I mean, it was I want to say maybe a bastardization of the republic system, but it wasn't, because it was within the confines of the republic system.
Mm-hmm.
But it took it to another level to say that I don't care what the federal government does. We're going to do what we want. And that's where you got a lot of the segregation in schools and busing and things like that. So Lee Atwater, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort decided that that's how they were going to do it. And they grabbed the Southern people who were already racist, but at the time Democrats, and got them to transfer their party allegiance to the Republicans. So, and these are my thoughts, of course, you know, but so what you get is a core base, because, I mean, as we know now, basically the stronghold of Republicans is the South.
Sure.
They sometimes lose mountain states, sometimes, but mostly they keep the mountain states. But the stronghold is the South. And it started with racism. So they created a base for themselves that was perfectly willing to hate someone else as a group. Well, it really wasn't quite enough, because when the 70s started rolling around, it wasn't winning them major majorities. Like, because of the Nixon fallout, the Republicans couldn't take the House. They didn't have the House for 40 years after Nixon's impeachment, 20 years after Nixon's impeachment, which is a long time, you know, and they wanted the House. So, and I'm not sure exactly where this, like, who started this movement, but I know that previously in American politics, you could not count on, I want to say, I'm going to use the term evangelicals blanket, all right?
Okay.
That I would use that term to describe your more fundamentalist-leaning Protestant religions in America. Okay?
Okay.
And the evangelical movement, before the late 60s, early 70s, they pretty much refused to vote. Like, their interpretation of the Bible was that they weren't supposed to get involved in politics, and that included voting. Most of them just did not vote.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and that's really, I mean, when I first found out about that, that really kind of blew my mind, because every evangelical I've known throughout the course of my life has been probably the most dedicated voter I've ever met, besides myself and a few other people, you know?
Yeah.
But for the most part, they've been just dramatically into politics. Well, in the 70s, early 70s, and you can actually, if you look hard enough, you can find some old videos, like probably on YouTube. That would be a whole other subject that you could take an hour just talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republican Party knew that if they didn't grab more dedicated, a racist is dedicated, you know,
yeah,
and they'll continue to vote for someone they think is a racist, or a party they think is racist with them, you know. The whole time, mind you, that this is going on, you got guys like Buckley and Bill Kristol's dad denying that there's any racism in the Republican Party. There's just no way they could be racist. They're Lincoln's party, right?
Yeah.
All the while. Yeah, yeah, exactly. All the while they're grabbing these racist elements and almost locking them in to being Republicans. And by now they have locked them in, you know. Because I don't know too many racists that vote Democrat. I just don't. I've heard racists say, well, I vote Democrat. And I'll say, when was the last time you voted for Democrat? And they can never say. So,
yeah,
you know, like that happened a lot during the Obama years. Well, I voted, you know, I voted for a Democrat before in my life. Yeah, when was that? Well, I don't know. You know, always the guys who were birthers.
Sure. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, you go back to the 70s and we talk about this strategy to get evangelicals, because somebody very, very smart in the Republican Party figured out if we could lock in these people, these evangelicals, which, you know, of course, in the Venn diagram of racist assholes, there's a big intersection between evangelicals and just racists, you know, like, you know, because fundamentalists tend to, one philosophy of a lot of fundamentalist Christian churches in America is that everyone is of God, but people with darker skin tone are cursed by God. So they are God's children, but they don't really count quite as much, you know?
Yeah.
It's obscene. It's obscene. So they decided that they were going, it was after Roe v. Wade, and the Republicans decided they were going to use that as an issue to grab evangelicals permanently. And I mean, as you can tell, it has worked. I mean, it's worked stupendously, to steal the word of old Donnie Two Scoops, you know, because you can't find someone who's an evangelical, a true evangelical, you know, in the culture of misogyny and that's another podcast in general.
Homophobia? How about some homophobia?
Oh, just so much hatred rolling out of there. But it's worked. I mean, you can't find people who are evangelicals that would vote Democrat. You just can't. And you used to, like when I was a real little kid in the South, I would occasionally talk to a Southerner who would vote Democrat. They call them Dixiecrats.
Oh, I've heard that term. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, well, not it was enough. A Southern Democrat, a Dixiecrat. Yeah. They don't really even exist anymore. It's kind of like the Blue Dog Democrat. Have you ever heard that term before?
I've heard Yellow Dog. What's Blue Dog Democrat? Is it
a Blue Dog Democrat is basically a and I got to tell you, every time I use the word conservative now, I do air quotes because I don't even really believe that it exists anymore after the age of Trump. But they were conservative Democrats. They were Democrats who, you know, believed in gun rights or maybe leaned a little more towards states' rights in what that term really means rather than like in a racist way, you know?
Okay.
But they were the children of, have you ever seen the Dukes of Hazzard?
Not so much. I think it was on TV in Ireland when I was a little kid, but I would have been so young. And at any time after that, I remember I was like, wait a minute, is that racist Confederate flag on the car? No, I'm not watching.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it sure was. Well, you remember the characters, though, right?
Yeah, kind of. There was like a blondie guy, and there was a guy who wasn't blondie, and then...
Okay, you know what? A better example. I got a better example.
Yeah, okay.
Foghorn Leghorn, you know who he is, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you've seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I would assume?
You bet.
Okay, so the guy in the white suit, the politician in the white suit, the governor, the actual governor who's running for re-election against Homer Stokes or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
He's modeled after an actual politician.
Oh, okay.
As is Foghorn Leghorn. They're modeled after actual Southern politicians, Dixiecrats.
Ah, okay. That's interesting.
And interestingly, they had such a lockdown on the state politics that if you were a Republican in the South, you had to hide because you were a fan of Lincoln. Like, that's how they framed it.
Wow.
Well, that goes back to, that's way further back in American history, back to Reconstruction and just, have you ever heard, you know what, in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, when he says, you unreconstructed, wherever you said, I don't remember exactly when that is or what word follows it, but that's classic Old South right there.
Ah, okay.
And so what you have is over the course of the 60s and 70s, since the South is chiefly the Bible Belt, right? Mm-hmm. Chiefly. What you have is a cementing of a Republican base, a permanent Republican base, because it's about religion and it's about hatred, you know, racial hatred. I should go on record, by the way, saying that I cannot stand the word racism. It is completely inept. We are all one race, but I'm going to use that word because there's no better word for it.
Okay.
But I think that the word racism is one of the ugly byproducts of the Enlightenment age, quite frankly.
Okay.
So you have the cementing of the base, right? We're moving into the 70s. The economy's not doing very well. Well, I mean, it kind of is, but it's not like it was in the 60s where, like, everybody was just, you know, the middle class was exploding. You could get a job right out of high school and support a family of four for the rest of your life. Well, you know, through the 60s. And you still kind of could in the 70s. But in the 70s was when corporations really started to conglomerate together, right? And then get their tendrils into the legislative process. Yeah, that's when heavy, heavy corporate lobbying started. Real heavy corporate lobbying. And there's going to be plenty of people who hear this and say, yeah, but if you go back to the Gilded Age, and yeah, that's fine. You go back to the Gilded Age, but we passed laws after the Gilded Age to prevent that stuff from happening. What happened in the 70s is that you had baby boomers who were really, really, really good attorneys. And that's the truth. Baby boomers were basically told they should be attorneys, they should be doctors, you know, high dollar professional, you know, money people, that kind of thing, right? Whoa, sorry. Still getting over that cold.
Oh, yeah.
So these baby boomers, they're getting out of college right at the beginning of the 70s, and they're getting into the professional world, and they're really, really good at what they do. For instance, guys like Lee Atwater and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone.
Right.
Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that every baby boomer that became an attorney had no scruples, because that's a ridiculous statement.
Of course.
But there are examples of, well, I should say, of the results of baby boomers who became really good attorneys that we can see today, you know, like there was a prohibition on lobbying right out of Congress, right? Well, they built a little rule in that as long as you don't actually say that you're lobbying, you're not really lobbying.
Okay, expand on that for me.
Okay, so to lobby, you have to there's like everything else in America, like everything else in a democracy, really, there's regulations around lobbying, okay? And to be considered an actual lobbyist, you have to spend X amount of time with X amount of client over the course of different clients. You know, like you don't have to do it with just one. You have to do it with multiple clients, right? To be a lobbyist, like you can lobby for someone, but you need to lobby for someone to a few different entities, and then claim that activity as lobbying activity to be considered a lobbyist. Does that make sense?
I mean, it does and it doesn't. It makes sense in that your explanation is clear, but as a policy, it doesn't make sense.
Oh, it's a terrible policy.
Yeah.
It's a terrible policy.
Yeah.
I mean, and don't get me wrong, there are guidelines, and I would assume laws, but probably guidelines, given how weak some of this stuff is. There are guidelines around things that force you to claim particular activities as lobbying activities. Fair enough?
Okay.
But let's say, for instance, Jeff Flake leaves Congress, right? Mm-hmm. And he can't lobby for a year, I believe it is, currently. It's a year, I think. Well, what he can do is he can go work for just, for example, Boeing or something, right? And he can talk to legislators under a certain amount of minutes a day and not be considered a lobbyist.
Okay.
Are you with me?
Yeah.
So it's a joke, you know? I mean, it's a freaking joke. Yeah. It really is. It's a joke. Well, in the 70s, that's when that started, going back to the beginning of it, you know? That's when that started in the 70s. Well, started en masse again. Like back in the Gilded Age, it was going on all the time, but, you know, the laws we passed made that. And you also have to remember that the period of the Great War and then World War II was not business as usual for American politics. So you can take about 30 years out of the 20th century and just kind of separate it from the rest of our political history, I guess you could say.
Okay.
Because there was, and I say that because there was more unanimity on a lot of the policy decisions and political decisions, you know, like the two parties were more aligned with each other as far as like what they wanted America to be doing.
Right.
Yeah. And it was before movement conservatism too. So, you know, I mean, those guys, don't get me started on those guys, man. I could do a whole podcast on conservatism and just still not figure out why they've never done what they said they were going to do, you know? So we got the 70s. Sorry, I'm prattling.
No,
we got the 70s.
What we're part of what we're doing here as well is we are laying a bit of a very rough map for future episodes.
That's kind of what I'm trying to do, actually. That's why I wanted to do this history, was to kind of Yeah, exactly what you just said, like a broad spectrum to extrapolate on little pieces of, you know? So the 70s rolls through and our economy is taking a hit, right? This is around the time where Wall Street is just about to start to get hot again. And I mean hot from, I mean, there was a period at the turn of the century that Wall Street was everything. It was towards the end of the Rockefeller years, towards the end of the, it was the steel barons and the oil barons. And that was all going on right then, you know, the Gilded Age. And then it calmed down a little bit, other than weapons, of course, you know, for the wars. And that's when a lot of your bigger weapons companies were born and some of your more contractors were born. And then in the 60s, when corporations really started to take off because their middle class had so much money to spend, you got a lot of Wall Street activity there, which I think is one of the reasons that baby boomers were encouraged to get into money, positions of money management, because it was so clear that that was going to be the future, you know, and it was clear. In the 70s, a lot of that mellowed out. Like, I don't know if you ever saw The Big Short, but it was a really good example of, you did. Okay. So the 70s was that time when these money guys, they were all old school guys. Their dads did it. Their dad's dads did it. And they just kind of sat and were mellow. They were like, okay, well, I'm getting X amount of dollars a quarter. It's coming up maybe, you know, a couple $1,000 a quarter. I'm still making money, more money, a little bit more money every quarter. So they just rested on their laurels and they let the market do its thing. Don't get me wrong. They were buying and selling and stuff. I mean, that's what the market is, but they weren't working hard to find new ways to make money, because the ways they were making money was fine. So what was happening was that the people to make more money on dividends, they started hitting the American worker. Unions were still pretty heavy at the time, a lot of union stuff. So what they were doing was they were negotiating with unions and non-union workers. They weren't negotiating with non-union workers, obviously, but this is where the American workers' paycheck started to stagnate, really. Because this is where the people at the top, who, mind you, were the baby boomers, right? They were starting to be upper management, maybe not CEOs, but middle to upper management. And they were good. They were way better than the guys that were doing it before. Because the guys that were doing it before, again, their dads did it. Their dads' dads did it. They were there by inheritance, by legacy, rather, more than they were by earning their way there. Right? So what you have is you have a bunch of people, and this holds true for a lot of American society as far as careers and work activity goes in general in the 70s and then into the 80s. Was that you had a lot of the baby boomers who didn't necessarily come from a legacy, but were so much better at their jobs than the people above them who did. Right? And they were.
Yeah.
They were the ones who came up with the ideas of, oh, you know, if we just cut off, if we give a nickel less of a raise to every one of our employees this year, we're all going to make another couple $1,000 on our dividends. All of us. No one had ever thought of anything like that before.
Yeah.
You know, because and that's just, I mean, like, that's commonplace now, that we think of that as a given, you know?
Yeah.
But that wasn't what it was before. Like, if you wanted to make more money on your stocks before and you were a business owner, you just fired a bunch of people. Or you invested. And they don't even really invest anymore, because the baby boomers taught them they didn't have to. You don't have to spend money to make money anymore, they said. You could just spend less. So, America's getting unhappy. Are you there?
Oh, yeah. I'm listening.
Okay. So, America's getting unhappy. Americans are getting... I got to check the time. Americans are getting unhappy. Oh, we're good.
You okay?
Because their paychecks aren't going up anymore. And this is around the time where the auto companies decide they're going to start using planned obsolescence, you know? Like, it's getting dirty. Corporations are getting dirty to make more money. And... God, I hate saying things like this. I really do. But it's the baby boomers who were doing those things fault, because it was their ideas. And they're starting to finally get into the political realm. Okay. Like, this is the late 70s is around the time guys like Newt Gingrich started running for local office.
Okay.
Okay. So meanwhile, the political parties are starting to get further apart. You still have Blue Dog Democrats. You still have liberal Republicans, right? You still have some Northern Republicans. You still have some Southern Democrats. But that's mostly legacy stuff, you know? My dad voted for Democrats. His dad voted for Democrats. I'm going to vote for Democrats, right?
Right.
Even though I live in BFE, Alabama, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But over time, you know, that the religion and the bigotry took that over. I don't care what my dad did. I identify more with these people who say they're Christians. Or this guy really doesn't want black people in my school. Neither do I. Or, that just, sometimes it just stuns me to say those things. It just really does. I can't believe they come out of people's mouths, you know?
It's heartbreaking. You know, actually, can I just bring up something that comes up a lot in my mind when you and I talk generally, actually, but listening to, you know, while we're doing this episode, I feel like for me, when I think of America in my lifetime, it's the story of the erosion of norms. And
I would say America seems to have norms.
Sorry?
I would say America. Are you talking political norms or societal norms?
Well, I think the two are very tied. But I think political norms is what I'm most interested in this area.
I would say generally, this is my personal opinion. Of course, I'm not a, you know, I'm not a scholar on these things, but I would say generally from what I've observed that those norms move in cycles. Like, and I will go back to the Gilded Age for this. It was the norm before senators were elected that governors would put rich plutocrats, really, into senator spots because they were appointed by governors or the legislators.
Okay.
They would put rich, powerful business people in those spots. And the norm was it was the Senate's job to protect businesses. Like, that was the norm for probably most of American history.
Okay. Okay.
But that cycled out. It was the norm for a long time. For there was no primaries in parties for who was going to be their presidential nominee. It was decided by the people at the top of the party. You're going to run for president.
Okay.
I think that, and on a sidebar on that, I think that the reason I use that as an example of norms is that I think that until Trump, the Republican Party still did that. I think that they did it in a fashion. It's actually best illustrated by Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line.
Okay.
I think they did it in a fashion that made it seem like the primary voters were voting for who they wanted. But generally, every cycle, the primary voters in Iowa would vote for somebody way out there. And by the time it got past the big three primary votes, they usually had cemented on someone that the Republicans pretty much figured they wanted anyway.
Okay.
And I think that the party itself, I mean, it's impossible to know what goes on within a party unless you're a member of that party and you're a member of the higher ups of that party.
Mm-hmm.
But my assumption is that it's the classic backroom deals, you know, like, hey, dude, we don't want you. It's not your turn. You know, we're going to promote this guy, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I would say that someone like when Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa straw poll in, what was that, 2006, I want to say, just before the 2007, I would say that she probably was just ignored. Like, I would say that the rest of the party establishment ignored her. A, she was a woman. B, she was said really crazy things. And C, I'm not real sure she was very smart.
Okay.
Like, I think that she was one of the early entries into the Republican Party of purposeful ignorance, and which is where I'm going next, actually. If you move out of the 70s and into the 80s, the Republican Party has become the party of corporatism by then. I mean, that's it. They're going full on anti, you know, Reagan. Reagan got elected in 1980, you know? You get the backlash from Carter, who most of the country thought was a weak president. And and who was elected, by the way, as backlash for the Republican beforehand, you know? So you get Carter and then into Reagan, and they call him the great communicator for a reason, man. I mean, he pulled all but one state. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know? I mean, all but one state. And I think that Reagan had a lot of things that people still look to politically today that he said. Maybe not the things he did, the things he said. Like, Reagan considered it dirty words to say, "I'm here from the government and I'm here to help." Like, those were dirty words to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, this is where we see, in my opinion, the cementing of what the Republican Party is today was Reagan. And I say that because now I'm going to move from the base and I'm going to talk about the establishment of the party a little bit. The establishment of the party loved Reagan. The base loved Reagan too, but the establishment loved Reagan because he espoused movement conservative ideals. I mean, if you remember, he had run and failed to get the nomination once before. So when he got it, he had tweaked himself into exactly what movement conservatives wanted to hear. Anything that the government can do, the private sector can do better. Let people lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. These are things that are common in the lexicon of politics. Well, you know, all right. When I say that, I'm going to have to say until Trump, okay? Because for the Republicans, those were things they said all the time. Lift you up by your own bootstraps. That was as common for Republicans to say as social safety nets for Democrats. Mm-hmm. So Reagan cemented what the Republican Party's policy ideas were going to be, and he couched them in folksy language so that the base would go along with it. Reagan also cemented what I like to call the triumvirate of Republican conservatism, which was social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, and I don't know why I call it, I guess it's stupid to call it conservative triumvirate, but, and then there were the war hawks, you know, the neoconservatives, I guess would be the best way of putting that. So it probably was a trifecta. Social conservatives being your religious types, fiscal conservatives being your Bill Buckley, let me think, well, there's not really too many left anymore. I guess Reagan was a fiscal conservative. Grover Norquist actually is a perfect example. Do you know who Grover Norquist is? Mm-mm. Okay, Grover Norquist is a guy who in the early 2000s made he grew prominent within Republican thinking circles as an anti-tax crusader. Okay, he felt that taxes were antithetical to what the federal government should be doing. He was almost a libertarian, but not quite. And he made every Republican sign a pledge that they would never raise taxes, or he would take his Club for Growth, who you might have heard of, he would take his Club for Growth's money and spend it against them in the primary so that they could have somebody there who would pledge to never raise taxes.
Wow.
Now, that's almost 20 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. That still pervades in the Republican Party. Grover Norquist is famous for saying, and I'm not going to say it's a quote exactly because I'm probably going to get it wrong, but he wanted to starve the federal government of tax dollars and drown it in a bathtub.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very – he is – oh, okay. Grover Norquist was the guy that said the Republicans don't even really need a president. They just need somebody with enough working digits to sign bills.
Now, that's interesting.
Which is fascinating because that's exactly what they have right now.
Yeah. That's spooky, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it really was. Like, when he said that and then Trump came up in the primaries, brother, that was the first thing I thought of. I was like, Grover Norquist just got his man.
Really?
Because he doesn't know anything about policy. I mean, he just doesn't. And he doesn't care, you know? He just wants to occupy the White House and be the star. That's it. That's all he wants.
Sure.
And he's got enough working fingers to sign bills. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. The only problem is he's an idiot. So he's, you know, taking them down with him. I will say this because I'm probably going to say this more than once in these podcasts. The day that the night that Donald Trump came down that escalator, I had to go to work the next that night. And my manager was an old tanker. Well, not old. I mean, he was only a few years older than me, but he was a guy who became my friend, and he was a tank commander for his entire military career. Got out as a major, I believe. He started out enlisted and then got out as a major.
Wow.
And he's a lifelong Republican, and a lot of career military guys are, because Republicans treat the military really well, mm-hmm. as far as like spending money on toys. Yeah. But they don't really treat soldiers real well. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Corporate speaking, they treat the military really well. People speaking, not so much.
Yeah.
But soldiers love toys to blow things up. So, you know, they're going to get a Republican vote. Well, I walked up to my friend that night, and I said, you know, Donald Trump just announced his candidacy for the president, for the nomination for your party. And he said, oh, man, really? And I said, yeah. And I said, I'll tell you right here, right now, he's going to win, and he's going to destroy your party. And he said, there's no way he'll win the nomination. There's no way. And he did, and he is.
It's not a fun thing to be right about.
It's a terribly depressing thing to be right about, quite frankly. Yeah. But I think that the Republican Party was due for a little creative destruction, because in the 80s, look at that, going right back, huh? Right. Look at that segue. Because of the 80s, they really just turned into like full on corporate, man. I mean, like, they had their social base, but they let them do their own things. You know, like, once they knew that the religious people were going to vote, that the conservative Catholics and the conservative Protestants were going to vote for them all the time anyway, they just started ignoring them. They really did. Like, oh, we're going to get rid of Roe versus Wade, but they never did anything about it. Now, that's what's key here. Okay. The Republican Party establishment has brought this upon themselves because they've been telling their base, not the fiscal conservatives, not the neocons, because they've been doing what they want. Like, they have been. Well, actually, that's not true. The neocons, they have. Are you familiar with neocons and what that's about?
You know what? Only in passing, and I'd love to know more about it. So can we put that on the board?
we sure can. Yeah, we sure can. So, but in a nutshell, really fast, neocons believe in an interventionist foreign policy.
Okay.
That's not, of course, their whole thing, but that's where they were. And the Republican base did like war. It's patriotic, and it's, you know, you get flyer flags all the time and mission accomplished and all that crap, you know? Mm-hmm. So they did cater to the neocons. Plus, that's corporate, you know? I mean, that's like a corporate thing too. So of course they were okay with that. And I'm talking about the Republican leadership and establishment here. In the 80s, you're getting guys like Gingrich is starting to come up, you know, like he's in the state legislature. I'm going to use I like to use Gingrich as my bellwether. I don't know if you know, but Steve Kornacki just came out with a book about tribalism starting in the 90s. And I've thought that for probably 20 years now, because I got to tell you, that's exactly when it started. And I blame Newt Gingrich almost personally for it.
Wow.
Frankly. Oh, dude, we'll do a whole thing on Newt Gingrich sometime.
Yeah, let's
okay.
Do it.
Do you know that he was a communications major?
No.
Well, there you go. Because now we have I laugh at that because we have a Republican Party, and we're seeing examples of it right now. They don't have policies to run on, but they have communications to run with. Mm. And since they're more focused on winning elections than actually governing, they've become the party of communications. Which is yet another reason why Trump did so well, because he's a brilliant communicator to the right kind of person.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, actually, he's a brilliant communicator in general. I mean, he uses words repetitively, but I mean, dude, there's a reason Dora is popular with kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of equate Trump to like Dora speak, basically, which is terrible because Dora is a fine cartoon that teaches kids all kinds of great stuff.
Yeah.
So we got the 80s, and the Republicans have gone full on corporate. They're ignoring their base. They're just ignoring their base because their base is shrinking to less and less of America by the time George H.W. Bush leaves office. Their base is maybe about 30% of America.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, about 25-26% of America is evangelical Christian at the time.
Okay.
Which says a lot, you know? I mean, it says a lot. I mean, and by base, I mean people that will always turn out to vote and will always vote Republican for them. Okay. Right.
The loyalists.
The loyalists. Yeah, exactly. Core voters, you know, the dependable ones.
Yeah.
They're shrinking. They're shrinking it. And it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And they're losing minority votes by the 80s already, because Reagan would say things like welfare queens, which was full on designed to stoke white anger. You might as well have said states' rights.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Reagan made things up too. He was a brilliant communicator. There was no person, this welfare queen that he loved to spout about, that wasn't even a real person, and it wasn't even something that was really happening.
It wasn't even possible.
It wasn't even possible. And the funny thing is that there, the Republican base still believes that goes on today. Like, if you tell your average Republican base voter, hey, dude, you know what? You're going on about welfare and black people, but like 83% of people that are on welfare are white. Mm-hmm. They just don't believe you. They just call you a liar.
Oh, yeah.
And they have since the 90s. Okay. So in the 80s, we have this Republican Party that's starting to ignore its base fully. You know, they're just, right. They're not trying to get rid of Roe v. Wade. They're not trying to. They're doing token things like ignoring AIDS because it was a gay problem, right?
Sure.
But they're not actively courting what the base wants. They're just not doing what the base doesn't want. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, actually, yeah.
Okay. We move into the 90s, right? And you get the Clinton years. And really, this is when it starts. And I can't agree with Steve Kornacki any more than I do right now. This is where it starts. Newt Gingrich was a communications major, right? He went to speak. Now, he was a nobody in Congress, dude, a nobody. But he came up with the Contract for America, which was, at the time, there was some, what's the word I'm looking for? Some corruption in the Democratic Party, but not a lot. Really more, it was just scandals. Like, this guy was sleeping around on his wife, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't like to make excuses, because if you're in a leadership position, you are held to a higher standard. But these were things that good humans sometimes do too.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, that's an important distinction as we go forward.
It is, yeah. You know, like, I don't want to say that by any means the Democratic Party was perfect, because, I mean, they're it's made of humans, you know? But the entire time all this is going on, since Nixon, you have, by the time the 90s hits, since the Nixon administration, probably over 200 Republicans have already gone to prison for outright corruption, things that bad people do, you know?
That's a crazy number.
Right. Just like outright corruption.
Can we do an episode on that?
Yeah, we can do,
I would like to do that.
You should put your computer out and write these down, because I'll never remember.
Yeah. Well, what we'll do is we're going to, this is our test episode. So
yeah,
we're going to, oh, by the way, let's call it in a few minutes, because we're at 42 minutes.
Okay. We want to do 45 like every time.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we can do, I'm totally cool to do an hour if you want, actually, but I know you're short on time today.
I am. I just looked at what time it was. All right. Well, let's make it quick then. Okay.
Yeah. Let's go
as quick as we can. Yeah. So, now, I want to stress again, it went from Reagan, a great communicator, to Gingrich, a great communicator, right?
Right.
Like, it's politics is about communication, and the Republicans have always had an advantage that their people are great communicators. Like, that's one of the reasons that the Democrats did so well, was because Kennedy was an amazing communicator, you know? Nice. The politics is about communication, you know? Like, it's the exercise of power, and if you want to exercise power, you need good communication skills. So Gingrich, who was a nobody, has the Contract for America. It was 10 things that he was going to change about Congress. Well, he promised the Republican Party would change about Congress if they were to take over the House and the Senate. Well, they took over the House, but not the Senate. And because Gingrich was instrumental in that happening, he became Speaker. Now, what Gingrich did, C-SPAN was new. Fairly new in the 90s, and they filmed 24/7. Like, they never turned the cameras off. Wow. So what Gingrich would do was, at night, when nobody was on the floor of the House, he would go in front of the C-SPAN cameras and just bloviate, literally bloviate, for hours and hours and hours at a time.
Shit.
To get his communicative messages out there.
That is
he
wild.
Would pound them. Yeah. And because it was free footage, I mean, people would watch it. It was free, you know, it was free footage
it's
of
there.
somebody
You're
talking.
up.
Right. And no one else was there to say boo about it. This is where pro-life became so popular. So the converse would be pro-death. Like, this is where the Republicans figured out the true power of communicating their message and what you could do to your opponent by calling yourself a certain thing.
Right.
This is where the term the Democrat Party came out rather than a Democratic Party. Gingrich made them call the Democrat Party. If you didn't, he'd drum you out of the party. If you couldn't stay with Gingrich's messaging, he'd drum you out of the party.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he was followed by Tom DeLay, who took it to kept the same communication strategies, but Tom DeLay was famous for truly integrating lobbying into the Republican Party. If you had ever given a penny to the Democratic Party when Tom DeLay was Speaker, you could never even walk in. He wouldn't take your phone calls. He wouldn't talk to you in a restaurant. Nothing.
That's
nothing.
Wild.
He and Gingrich are what taught the Republican base that Democrats were evil. And that's an important distinction. Real important, because that's when the Republican base started to integrate their religion truly into the party's policies and messaging. Because once you think somebody's evil, then they're not on God's side.
Right. And anything you do to defeat them is okay.
Good. Okay. Anything. All goes with God. You know that. It's all good. God told me to do it. It's all good. That's when it started. That was the time that started to enable Trump. After that, you get a bunch of yahoos in the party who really don't know what the hell they're talking about, like Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. And you have all these establishment Republicans who are just trying to figure it out. And then they have the Kochs making them ride the tail of the Tea Party or ride the tiger of the Tea Party, you know. And it just cascaded into this ridiculousness. It went from Reagan saying pointy-headed elites to Trump saying, if you don't agree with me, you're an idiot, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it went from, you don't even have to be educated to be an idiot if you disagree with the Republican Party now. You're just evil.
Yeah.
You're just evil, you know?
And that concludes our test episode. You'll be hearing a moderately more polished version in the future. Thanks for listening.